And we have two special guests for you tonight, all at the same time. It's going to seem like we're dealing with two separate shows with related topics, but you're going to enjoy this one as we talk about creation and destiny. So get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. The two guests you're about to hear have been on the program before. Tricia McKinnon is a renowned clairvoyant, historian, author, teacher. She's traveled the world in search of answers to some of the greatest mysteries of our ages. As a researcher and symbologist in many ancient paths of wisdom, she's known as the mysteries expert. And Tricia is trained as an initiate in many of the ancient streams of knowledge. Here's Tricia McKinnon. Hey, Trish, how are you?
Good evening, George. It's great to hear your voice again.
I'm looking forward to this tonight. It's going to be fun.
It's going to be fun. And let me just tell you, as much as you know and as much as I know, Peter is the same. We've got three really smart, funny people on the show tonight.
Well, let's bring Peter in. Peter, of course, for the past 30 years, Peter Canova has researched mainstream and alternative spiritual traditions as well as cutting-edge findings of quantum physics. As a young man, he experienced direct forms of contact with higher intelligence and information systems such as clairvoyance, remote viewing, and this led him on his lifelong journey to understand the forces that link humanity together with the unseen. Here's Peter Canova back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Peter, how are you?
George, it's great to be back, and it's a real pleasure to be on with you two guys.
It's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to this. Let me ask you, Tricia, first of all, what have you been up to since the last time you were on?
Oh, goodness gracious. Last year, 2011, I think I was on the road 7 months, and I'm sure both of you guys can relate, but I was in Europe for about 2 months, in Poland and England and Italy, and there's some amazing things going on over there. And, of course, Los Angeles and New York and San Francisco, and we've been quite active down here in the South, too. Of course, I live in Atlanta. And we have a really strong metaphysical, conscious community in this city.
You sure do. You really should do. And how about you, Peter? What's new with you?
Well, I'm happy to tell you that I'm starting to get some really serious interest out of Hollywood for turning Pope Annalise into a movie. And I've been working for the last couple months on the screenplay. We're dealing with some pretty serious groups of different people, producers, actors, and so forth, all unrelated, coming, at different places and from different times here. So I'm hoping that kind of bodes well for the future, and we'll see what happens.
Well, that's great. And Pope Annalise, of course, is your book that we talked about back in April. That's exciting.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of actually meeting Peter in February. We were both doing the Conscious Life Expo out of L.A., which is coming up again.
Well, and I trust I'm going to meet you both there, right?
Yes, you're going to be there speaking,
yes.
One of the major headliners, too. And then, of course, Kenny Kaufman's wonderful show, The New Living Expo, in April. And I got a chance to read his book, and it's a very, very intriguing book.
Well, tonight we're going to talk about the various aspects of tradition, of the creationism, the origin, the destiny of humanity, and how this happens. And Tricia, you're an expert, of course, in the Anunnaki, Zechariah Sitchin's work. And Peter, you're going to look more at the Edgar Cayce end of this, aren't you?
Yeah, the Edgar Cayce and some of the lost Judeo-Christian gospels that were recovered in the 1940s.
Okay, let's start by talking about some of these ancient mystery teachings. Tricia, how did they occur? I mean, who helped these people?
Well, I know that you are also a proponent of really studying Sitchin's work and
a lot of the
translations that come out of originally Sumeria and then Babylon, Assyria, Egypt, and that whole Middle Eastern area. And fortunately, from the genius of Zechariah Sitchin, those of us today have been able to discover a great deal about what we could call the history of the gods. And this is gods and goddesses, as you know, with a little g.
Mm-hmm.
And among them, just like with human beings, you know, you had the full assortment. They were very long-lived and tall beings from another planet, and that's a whole big conversation I'm sure we're probably going to have tonight. But some of them were very enlightened beings. And as you might expect for a race that seemed to live 500,000 years, that's a, you know, I imagine you'd learn something along the way if you live for half a million years.
I find it appropriate tonight that you're both on the day that science announces that most likely there could be billions of planets in our galaxy alone. Isn't that exciting?
Yeah, I love that. It's like science is really catching up, and it's wonderful to see the scientists who do open their minds to the possibility that we're not alone out there.
If Zechariah were alive today, he'd probably say, I told you so.
I think that's exactly what he'd say.
It was one of the highlights meeting him at an award ceremony at Conscious Life a couple of years ago. I do miss the guy.
He was really a great scholar and an amazing writer and researcher. And when you start talking about the mysteries, you know, what really begins to emerge is that although there were certainly Anunnaki gods that were down here for very physical reasons, like trying to repair their own ozone by mining gold in our planet and putting it as a shield in their own atmosphere, which is interestingly enough what we have discovered ourselves, that if we put gold foil sheeting on the windows of the astronauts' capsules, it protects them from the cosmic rays.
That's right. Isn't that interesting?
But you also had more enlightened beings, and at the top of that list really was Inki's family, which ruled most of Africa. And sort of in the topmost positions, I think, of consciousness there, you have Thoth, who, of course, was known as Tahuti and Hermes Trismegistus, or Hermes, thrice great Hermes, Mercury, the scribe of the gods, the god of wisdom. These are all just different names for the same long-lived being.
And Tricia, tell us why you honed in on Zechariah in his theories as part of the basis of what we're talking about tonight.
Well, you know, as you know, so much of the history of this planet has been lost. It's been destroyed through floods and avalanches and through the burnings of thousands and thousands of scrolls and books. I mean, just the Great Library of Alexandria had over 700,000 scrolls and books, and that was burned twice, once by the Christians and once by the Arabs. And so Sitchin went back to some of the original sources, the original text, and because he was one of about 10,000 people in the world that could actually read those Sumerian cuneiform texts, he translated them and he began to notice all these similarities between what modern technology has developed and references within the Sumerian text, and he put two and two together. So he managed to take the ancient, and we've caught up enough in technology to be able for him to see the parallels. And, for example, in Egypt, there's the classic story of, the lords of good, the lords of light that were helping humanity. This is, you know, Osiris and Isis, and how the evil half-brother Set wound up murdering Osiris, and Isis managed to impregnate herself and eventually give birth in secret to Horus, who grew up as the redeemer of that age, who fought his uncle Set and brought the balance back to the Force.
Interesting correlation with the birth of Jesus, though the story's different. It does have some tie-ins, doesn't it?
A lot of tie-ins, and this is one of the things I talk about in that book that I wrote, that when I was on your show last time, Jesus, the Explosive Story of the 30 Lost Years,
right,
and the Ancient Mystery Religions. I was talking about the fact that the Vedas, the ancient Indian Vedic writings, talk about the appearance of these four great Kumaras who come periodically to the earth at a time of great darkness in order to awaken humanity and raise the kundalini, or the consciousness. And Thoth, Horus, Osiris, Jesus, these are all incarnations of these same four great Kumaras, and each one of them has an M.O. Thoth is the one who created the mystery schools. And Thoth was an enormous believer in the divinity of the soul that lies within humankind. And even though we might only be living, you know, now 80-year lifetimes, although at one time I think we lived about 1,000 to 1,200, 1,500 years, as we hear those reports of Methuselah and Lamech in the Bible.
I wouldn't mind having their calendar, let me tell you.
Right. As long as we stayed in good health.
That's right. I don't want to be 1,000 years old and not healthy.
Yes.
That's not fun.
That's exactly right. So, you know, I think because at one time we were a much longer lived species, but even 1,000 years is nothing next to someone who lives for 500,000 years. So Thoth said of humans, he said, ye are gods in the body of mortals, and we are souls in the body of gods. So he acknowledged that the same divinity that was within them also lies within the heart of the human being, both male and female. And he set up the great mystery schools along with Isis, who was really his daughter, and Horus, who was really his grandson. And they did this in England, in France, in the Druid lands. They did it in Egypt. They did it in Persia. They did it in India. They did it in the Mayan lands, North America, South America, Central America. So it was called Quetzalcoatl. That was another
That's one of his
names. So when you begin to talk about the mysteries, you know, you have to really realize that these beings of light come periodically. Sometimes they come in a human form, as Jesus did, and sometimes they come in the form of a human being from another planet.
All right, well, let me ask you, Peter, and then we'll get into all of this. How did you key in on Edgar Cayce and the Judeo-Christian Gospels?
Well, you know, George, actually, as I studied a lot of different traditions, and including, you know, the Anunnaki, the Akkadian, Sumerian, Babylonian texts, I really came to believe that there was one universal wisdom or spiritual tradition way, way back in the midst of history, and that over time, through different cultures and things, there were modifications that were made. And so, you know, sometimes these things, they seem like they're at odds, but in reality, I think it's really sort of like when you focus your camera lens on a different part of the stage, but they're really all looking at the same stage.
Right.
And, you know, the mystery schools were certainly the places that were created to keep the sacred wisdom alive so that human beings would not completely forget their spiritual origins and get engulfed in the whole consciousness of materiality. And, you know, we can trace these things back, like maybe even as far as 12,000 BC, to shamanism. Now, shamanism was the simple belief that two worlds existed side by side, the spiritual and the material. And the shamans were those who walked between the worlds. They'd bring information back from the spiritual dimension to our plane, and they would use that, hopefully, for good purposes, for healing and providing guidance for people. And then it kind of evolved down around 3000 BC, prior to 3000 BC, we had the worship of the great goddess, because these mystics that were going into these other dimensions sensed a feminine quality that they had to use of intuition and desire, and they really sensed that it was a feminine aspect of the deity that had a lot to do with the creation of the material world. And so that, in part, is, you know, we see the great goddess worship prior to 3000 BC. So the mystery schools become a little bit more clear in our lens around 1500 to 1200 BC. Not that they weren't present before that, but, you know, they come a little bit more into focus then. And, you know, finally, I looked at the Western branches of these mystery traditions, which would have included the Essenes, among others, and certain Jewish and early Christian groups that had a little bit of a different take on the you know, these fundamental questions than Orthodox Christianity did, and they flourished in the Mediterranean basin around 500 BC to 400 AD. But you can sort of see their connections to the Sumerian materials. And one of the reasons why I kind of chose to talk about Cayce in addition to these lost gospels tonight is because I thought it would be kind of neat, with Trish talking about, you know, Sitchin's work, that we could cross-reference the information for these really deep questions of existence from traditions that stretch over different periods, cultures, and geographic locations to try and get like a little access or matrix of understanding life's deeper mysteries. So we have Cayce, for instance, who was a modern-day psychic. We had Sitchin, who was a modern scholar who unearthed ancient texts or deciphered ancient texts. And then we have the Judeo-Christian Gospels, that was a body of teaching from the early churches that were kind of suppressed. And it's very interesting to see how those cross-reference each other to tell us a story about some of the subject matter tonight.
I think Edgar Cayce, one of the greatest prophets who ever walked this planet, obsessed with him, Peter, when I was a youngster, and just never stopped, never stopped.
It changed my life when I read Tom Segura's book, There Is a River, because I think like a lot of people who sort of end up following a spiritual or metaphysical path in my early years before I, you know, could even articulate my own, you know, problems and questions and things like that. I had a stirring inside me that said, there's got to be something more going on than this. This just can't be the reality here. And when I started, when I picked up that book and I found out about Casey and I started to read his materials, it was a life-changing experience for me.
Sidney Kirkpatrick wrote a book called The American Prophet about Edgar Casey. Had him on the program locally many years ago, and then, of course, on Coast to Coast. And Casey was a remarkable man, wasn't he, Peter?
Well, he was, because not only did he give these incredible readings about Atlantis, about the origin of the human being, spirit and soul and everything else, but he was also very practical. I mean, as we know, he's probably even more known to the public for his medical readings that he gave people. And actually, that was of interest to me, George, because one of the first experiences that I had when I started to get on this path was I found out that I was a medical intuitive. And when I did my first reading with a great degree of accuracy, much to my surprise, because I never kind of dreamed that this was something that I would be doing.
Right.
Of course, my first analog there was Edgar Casey, and he was always in the back of my mind as these things happened. I said, it's all, what I'm experiencing now is almost like a validation of everything I read in Casey that he did.
You know, I tell you, I started reading Casey when I was 12 years old, and I probably like you guys at a very
same thing,
age.
Yeah.
And because, I've been clairvoyant since I was little, and I would see past lives for people, I'd see future events for people, I would see angels around them and spirit guides around them. And when I read this book, it was like, oh my God, I'm not alone. There are other people out there who see as I see. And, I remember thinking, when I was 12, I only wish that I could focus my gift enough to be able to go back in time and track people's soul records backward all the way up to their origin and then, follow them from the higher levels and watch how they've come down and how they've arrived where they are today and to discover, what they're doing in this lifetime. And, of course, that's actually what I've been doing now for over 25 years. With, over 6,000 readings with people around the world, is that very thing. But that wish was born when I read Edgar Casey.
Well, I also think, George, one thing the listeners will be very surprised at tonight is that Edgar Casey passed away in 1945, the same year that the Lost Gospels or the Nag Hammadi Gospels. These are the Nag Hammadi Gospels. I refer to them as the Lost Gospels of Judeo-Christian Gospels.
Right.
But these were a set of alternative gospels that were unearthed in Egypt in 1945, which was the same year that Casey died. I think the listeners are going to be astonished as to how close the Casey material tracked these gospels, and yet he could never have read them himself because he passed away before they were discovered.
That's just like Zachariah Sitchin dying in October of 2010, where suddenly there are photographs and videos appearing of what appears to be Nibiru moving through our solar system, starting in really 2009, being seen from Antarctica and then Australia and then 2010, India, Russia, 2011, Devon, England, and Norway as it passed in a 33-degree angle coming up from the South Pole, really, of the ecliptic.
It would not surprise me, Tricia, if that planet indeed was in our solar system somewhere, especially when they're talking about billions of other planets out there in the galaxy now. Stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment. We're going to have you explain the Sitchin Sumerian story, Tricia. And, of course, Peter, we'll get into some of the Edgar Casey material when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, the Coast to Coast Merchandise Blowout Extravaganza is starting this month. We are blowing out all the remaining Coast to Coast merchandise as we will be launching new Coast products for you in February. We're going to be just having some fun and also finding things for you that you could use as this Earth continues to change. But for now, We want to get rid of the shirts and caps and all those other things. So go to coasttocoastam.com, click the store link at the bottom of the page, and see if there's anything you want. It's simple as that. Okay, here we go with Tricia McKinnon and Peter Canovo as we talk about the various aspects of creation and origin. Peter, of course, and Tricia are going to be at the Conscious Life Expo in February. I'll be there as well. Peter, what are you going to be talking about there?
I'm going to be talking about quantum spirituality, where I'm taking the latest cutting-edge findings on quantum physics, and I'm juxtaposing those against the ancient spiritual traditions. But I'm particularly going to concentrate, George, on the holographic universe and how the whole concept that we live in a holographic universe was predicted in the ancient Gospels 2,000 years ago.
Super. Now, Tricia, let's talk a little bit about Zechariah. For people who might not know his work, tell us about his Sumerian interpretation.
Well, you know, Zechariah Sitchin was a Jewish man by birth and very much a scholar. And he began to come out with these amazing books that he called the Earth Chronicles series, I think around 1975. And there are about 10 of them. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners have read, you know, some of them, because he really became a classic. But when you kind of put it, I mean, a lot of people are aware of him now, thankfully, because of some of the amazing work that people like you, George, have been doing getting this word out, and because of the work of expos like the Conscious Life Expo and the New Living Expo and the New Age Expos that have happened around the world. And the New Sciences and Ancient Wisdom, which is what part of what Peter and I both talk about. Mm-hmm. I think that part of the point that I was making earlier when I was talking about some of the correlations that Sitchin made when I went back to the story about Horus was that in the story of Horus's fight with Set, they talk about the fact that he had his uncle, Jibal, basically, who was probably Vulcan, as we know of him as one of the Greek gods, he lived in a particular area in South Africa, and that he was one of the few that knew that Horus was alive because Isis had to keep his existence secret. And it took him about 350 years to grow to manhood. And then they presented him before the Council of the Gods, and there were always 12 gods. And these are the 12 gods we know from Olympus. And most of them were from the house of Enlil, which was, of course, in Samaria. And this is where we get Zeus, who was more than likely Ninhurta. Ninhurta was Enlil's son. And where Enlil's sign was the sign of Taurus, the bull. And he was the lord of the command. And he kind of ruled with a heavy hand. I don't think not particularly spiritually enlightened, that whole group. But in that battle, it talks about how Horus had basically a harpoon that was like a multiple warhead. Well, interestingly enough, our military has developed a multiple warhead called a harpoon.
That's right.
And so what Sitchin did that was just so brilliant was he took these creation stories that had just sort of become garbled and misinterpreted and mythologized and sort of made into some kind of cosmic mumbo-jumbo that no one could really understand. And he said, what if this isn't just a cosmic metaphor? What if it could actually be a real thing? For example, the movement of their planet, which was called Nibiru, but unfortunately when Marduk got into power, he kind of was in such a little temper tantrum snit because of the unfairness he felt that Enlil's family had dealt his family, that he renamed everything Marduk. So consequently, Nibiru got overlaid with the name Marduk. But in their creation story, Nibiru Marduk, in other words, their planet, came through our solar system, and it was so massive and so large that it created the destruction of a planet where the asteroid belt is now.
Uh-huh.
And that planet was called Tiamat, and it was a planet very much like Earth. It had water, had continents, doubtlessly had a lot of people on it too, and life forms. And it broke that planet up and broke up its satellites. And this is one of the theories about why when we went to the moon, we discovered that the moon has rocks on it far older than the Earth. And the dust on top of the rocks are far older than the rocks themselves. And we're talking like a billion years older. And it doesn't make any rational explanation from our point of view, because we've always assumed that the Earth was, you know, when the solar system was made, that the moon was pulled out of the Earth or was made at the same time. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it appears that the moon is much older than the Earth.
That's a great story.
Yeah, it's a very interesting. And so instead of Sitchin just taking it as an allegory that the great Marduk Nibiru came by and had this clash with Tiamat, and it's all some, and Tiamat being compared almost to a dragon, and how he had to slay her because she was almost as big as he was. He said, what if these were planetary spheres, and we're talking about the fact that this big old planet came through, and like any of us, we justify that our planet is the best planet. Well, Nibiru does actually seem to be, from the reports that I've looked at, some of which claim to be from NASA scientists who've lost their jobs and said, what do we have to lose? They say that the ratio of Saturn to Jupiter, which is quite large, I think Saturn is 600 times bigger than we are. So, and Jupiter's much larger than Saturn, they're saying that Nibiru is that same proportion larger than Jupiter.
Are there any other past civilizations that echoed similar stories, or was it just the Sumerians?
Well, I think all of them did, actually. I mean, from the Sumerian story of creation, which is the oldest one, really, that we know of in historic senses. Although, you know, there are earlier ages. Let me just say, there are earlier ages. For example, the Indian Vedic chronicles talk about the descent of many gods and goddesses who came down. And for a while, they got along. But as usual, just like with human beings, they went through periods where there was fighting and there were wars. And again, these Vimanas or UFOs or spaceships that they were flying had warheads and flaming missiles and the shields of invisibility. And so it appears that our planet has actually lived through many epochs. And many of these ages, we only have stories like the Mahabharata or the Ramayana, which tell the story of earlier ages. And of course, the East Indians consider these to be great tales that were true until Christianity and English imperialism went over there in the 1800s and made them almost embarrassed with their culture. But of course, now that we have satellite photographs, we've been able to look down and discover that there is, in fact, a land bridge underwater, as the Mahabharata talked about and the Ramayana.
Isn't that amazing?
Moving from the south of India all the way over to Australia. And this is, in fact, the very land bridge that Rama crossed in the Ramakrishna and his movement down to meet Ravana, the, you know, probably a reptilian, Rakshasa, or demon, or bad guy, and to fight a holy war to, you know, get rid of these demons that were terrorizing the people and, you know, going to the monasteries and killing the priest. And
well, I know, Tricia, that whenever anybody would question Zechariah's work to him or, you know, to someone else, and he would hear about it, he would go ballistic. He was so tuned into what he did that, you know, he didn't want to listen to anybody. You know, Michael Heiser, for example, has his own theories, and they don't echo Zechariah. Zechariah would go nuts. He was a toughie, wasn't he?
He really was. And, you know, he was not a very articulate speaker. He was very dry.
He was a writer.
He was a profound researcher and writer, really brilliant. It was hard to stay awake sometimes when he spoke because he didn't have the dynamic presentation. But honestly, the world owes him so much. He was really a genius.
Okay, let's bring you in for a little bit here, Peter, to talk about Edgar Cayce. We know a lot of what he's done. How did this happen for him?
How did he
get this ability?
Well, you know, it kind of came upon him. It started at a, I think he was in his, a young man, I think he was in his 20s, and he lost his voice.
He was a photographer at that time, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was a photographer. I think it was down in Tennessee somewhere. And he lost his voice. And he actually ended up giving himself a reading and prescribing his, you know, his own cure, which he, you know, eventually followed. Well, he was, you know, pretty startled at this. And then he started sort of giving these trance readings. Now, when you do readings, George, I'm sure you and Tricia are both aware, you have trance channelers and you have conscious channelers. When I would do my own, you know, channeling, as I put things in the book, I was always conscious. I was never able to do it in a trance state. Edgar Cayce used to lie down on the couch and he'd have a lady named Gladys Davis transcribe the things that he talked about, and he was totally astonished at the material that was coming out, because he was a pretty devout Christian.
So he'd read it afterwards and he'd go, oh my God, or he'd listen to it, right?
Yeah, exactly. He couldn't believe that it was coming from him. And he was a pretty devout Christian. And not that a lot of his readings didn't track some of the Orthodox Christian story, but it didn't track it completely. There were definitely variations in there, which, you know, if you were a very, very strict, almost what you'd call a fundamentalist Christian today, you know, that would probably be kind of shocking to you. And it was rather shocking to him. But, you know, as he progressed and he started to do more and more of the medical readings, and they were accurate and they were helping people and they were yielding, you know, tangible results in on the material level, you know, like anybody else, like riding a bicycle or anything else, you start to grow more confident in your own craft. And, you know, he had a long career from, I think, from the, you know, 1920s anyway, up until he passed away, of doing all types of readings.
The readings killed him, didn't it?
You know, that's an interesting thing, because I knew a gentleman in Florida that worked with the ARE, which is the Association for Research and Enlightenment out in Virginia Beach, which is the organization that Cayce founded, and various Cayce family members have run it for, you know, for years. I think somebody outside the family is heading it right now. But this gentleman was, the ARE considered him kind of the heir of Edgar Cayce. I think he's stopped giving readings now, but he was a friend of mine. I spoke to him for many years. He definitely was of the belief that it was taking a toll on him when he would give these readings, that it would take a certain amount of life energy, you know, out of you. And that, you know, he actually, one time when he gave up the readings, I think he had a very stunning revelation. A voice came to him, like with an exclamation point after it, saying, you know, you've got to stop now. My own experience, that is not my own experience. I kind of felt that it depended upon the mindset upon which you enter this, and that there's ways that you can minimize or shield yourself from those influences. But I also will hasten to add that I wasn't nearly doing the numbers of readings that these guys were doing. So, you know, there certainly is a case that a lot of these psychics and clairvoyant readers will make, that, yes, it does have that effect on you.
Well, I want to actually address that a little bit, because I'm sure that they're very tuned in people in the audience, and I've done a lot of readings.
The best, Tricia, the best out here.
Well, when I started doing readings publicly, you know, I was doing 6 and 7 a day. I mean, I was just, it was just, you know, you go into the zone, because you don't read from a beta brain state of consciousness. To be an effective reader, you actually drop into very deep levels of alpha, theta, and delta, because as we go down into the deeper mind, we move into the ability to access the Akashic records and the great galactic consciousness and the mind of God. So I think at the time Cayce came along, and this is part of what makes someone a trance channel or an untrance channel, is that a lot of times the personality of the person, although the soul might be a very evolved soul, the personality, like Cayce's, was much more steeped in traditional thought in the 1930s. 1920s, 1930s, he was really a pioneer.
That's right.
So in order to be able to do the remarkable work he did, there was a gap between the higher self that he was, that was obviously a very profound person, and the personality that did not understand a lot of the concepts that his higher self was bringing through him. And I think it's sometimes it's this difference that makes it, it's a lot of effort. And obviously, the more the conscious personality can learn to meditate and to drop into those deep states of consciousness and be fed so that there's not a gap between the conscious self and the higher self, it helps. But now I do about 3 readings in a day, and that's enough. You know, 2 hours a person, that's enough. And it's very energizing for a while, but when you, after you do it for about 10 days, you can't, you just have to stop. You know, you literally have to go take 2 or 3 days for yourself to fill up the well. Because I think when a lot of people come to us, they don't just come for insight, but they come because they have a lot of problems. And they're really needing very deep answers to very deep issues. And it takes a lot of energy to find those answers for them.
Well, I think actually I always had an easier time while I was in my level and I was doing the readings than I had being in my conscious state trying to explain the results of the readings to people. That's when it was taking more of a toll on me.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that.
Do you do readings, George?
No, not publicly. I mean, I'm pretty intuitive, as you know, Tricia, but, you know, I don't do readings. I've done some hands-on healing for 2 people, and it worked dramatically, and I have not done it since.
Well, again, I think it's this ability to align yourself with really the current, and if you pull it in from the higher sources, it literally vibrates you to a higher space so that you're almost more energized than when you began. But after you've done it for enough days, what happens is it's very hard for the mortal frame, especially in the Western world, because we're having to do things like get up and take our children to school and pay bills and go to jobs, and or so much of our time is spent just dealing with the busyness of life. It's very difficult. Plus, our diets. Most of us don't have diets that are keeping our cells in this higher frequency. You know, we're eating hamburgers and french fries and all that kind of stuff. And this is, of course, why a lot of times people who did this kind of work, they became yogis and ascetics, because as they, purified their physical bodies, they were able to hold this higher frequency and have more of their higher self come in and dwell their physical form. And this is one of the things with a lot of masters. When you actually reach that place where your physical and your emotional and your mental and your spiritual are all really vibrating at the same point. But even a master can, you know, be seduced by the lower worlds.
And let's look at our third area here. We've talked about Sitchin. We've talked about Edgar Cayce. And we're going to get into some of the roles of souls and what the gods meant to everybody. But the Nag Hammadi, Peter, do they echo the Dead Sea Scrolls? Are they similar?
Not really.
Okay.
And you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls, I want to make a little bit of a distinction here, because, of course, the people associate the Dead Sea Scrolls with the Essene community.
Yes.
That was along near En Gedi, along the Dead Sea. And at least in my research, there's a little bit of a distinction to be made between Essenes, because there was another Essene community at Mount Carmel. I believe that is the one that Jesus probably had came out of that Essene school.
It was a different sect, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was there was a difference between them. The Essenes of the Dead Sea were actually fairly fanatical. And in their own way, almost as fanatical as maybe some of the Orthodox, priesthood of their time.
Mm-hmm.
And look, there are certain small areas of overlapping, but by and large, the focus of the Nag Hammadi Gospels is on different things than the Dead Sea Scrolls.
All right, hold on, Peter. We're going to hit this break pretty soon, and we're going to come right back. We've got a couple more hours to go with Peter Canova and Tricia McCannon as we talk about the creation, the origin, and destiny of humanity. So we'll be back with both of them in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.